Pleasure to be here. So the title is up here. Let me start by sort of saying very briefly where we are with the Higgs. I think you guys all know, but just as a reminder, the Higgs has been discovered. We're all convinced it's the Higgs. And we're beginning to actually test the question whether it's the Higgs with the properties predicted by the standard model or not. And just to remind you, the standard model, once you know the Higgs mass and everything else that we know about the standard model makes absolutely unambiguous predictions about the Higgs couplings to all the other particles in the standard model. Those predictions can be used to calculate appropriate rates of Higgs production cross-section times branching ratio of decays into various channels. And the rates can be measured and compared to the standard model prediction. And that program is already underway. So this is the status as of a couple of months ago. The way this is done in, so this plot is from Atlas, this one is from CMS. Let me focus on CMS just for concreteness. The way it's done is the rates are sort of divided out by the standard model rates. So the standard model prediction is one in that normalization for all channels. One is this dashed line here. And experimental points are the black points. And you see they are in beautiful agreement with the standard model, probably better than we ought to expect based on the error bars that are also shown on this plot. But anyway, the point is everything agrees with the standard model. And the error bars are, they depend a lot on the channel. So probably the best one is this kappa v. V can be a W or Z. They're kind of lumped up together in this analysis. Gamma is also pretty good. And then others are progressively worse. But the best ones are sort of 10 to 20% precision. So that's the, roughly speaking, the order of magnitude to keep in mind. So for you know, what we have now, the single experiment is probably the best one, is 15%. If you try to naively combine experiments, you can get them down to 10%. Again, the V and the gamma are the most sensitive ones at the moment, and they all agree with the standard model.
So kappa G is the coupling of norms deduced from the production cross-section?
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah. There are also there are some assumptions in this that are probably worth mentioning. The assumption here is that there are no new decay channels that are unobserved. Okay. If you allow for that, this error bars will increase dramatically. Because there is basically you can reduce all the branching ratios by postulating some new unobserved channels, and then you can increase the production cross section by a corresponding factor. And there is little, there are eventually constraints in that direction, but they're very weak. So this in particular, this kappa glue relies crucially on that assumption. As probably all of you know, last year we had the snow mass. Planning for the future kind of process, where there was a Higgs working group, and people spent a lot of time trying to figure out for both the LHC, the future LHC program, and various other proposed facilities, such as E plus and minus Higgs factories, what the, you know, how much you can shrink the error bars on these various couplings. The results are that at the LHC, you can probably go down to about 5% precision. There are some people claiming that you can go down to 2 or 3%. This actually requires shrinking theory errors, which are mostly related to PDFs and higher order calculations. So this is a little bit hard to, you know, predict how that will go. But a sort of few percent is a number to keep in mind. And this is high luminosity LHC. So this is at the end of the sort of full run 15 years from now or something like that. Okay. Another thing that's been actively discussed at snow mass is the proposals for electron-positron colliders running at about 250 GeV, which is an optimal number for producing a lot of Higgs bosons. So they made projections. Of course, you know, these things are not real machines yet, right? So they're sort of projections at the stage of design. But the claims are pretty interesting. So the claim is that this ZZH coupling, which is particularly well probed in E plus and minus, can be probed at the level of 0.1%. Okay, and depending on you know, what collider and who is doing the projections, it can be 0.05, it can be 0.3, but basically this is sort of the ballpark number, the order of magnitude to keep in mind for those things. And this is really impressive, right? This is one part per mil, so this is approaching the levels of precision electroweak measurement. Yeah?
The dashed lines on those plots, is that just representing kind of the uncertainty of different models?
Yes, so the dashed line, the bar with the dashed line assumes no improvement in theory.
Oh.
Okay. And yeah, the blue one assumes halving the theory errors. Okay.
What is the green thing?
Oh, the green thing is TLAP. TLAP is. TLAP is a circular 250 GeV plus or minus collider with four detectors, which shrink error bars by a lot. I should sort of put an asterisk here. You know, TLAP is an idea that's only been discussed for a year or two now, unlike the ILC, which has a technical design report, which is actually a pretty detailed description of, you know, what the thing would be if it gets built. TLAP is more sort of ideas flying around, so you should probably take these with a grain of salt, but that's what does the numbers that the people interested in pushing this provided.
Why is it so much more difficult to improve the gamma, the coupling to photons?
It's just the W and Z are easier. Well, the Z is easier because the production cross section is the production process is a plus or minus to ZH. Right, so you're just measuring that thing directly as a cross-section measurement. So that's why that's better than everything else. But the others are sort of at 1% level. Okay.
Is the reason that the green is so much better just statistics?
Yes, that's right. So the claimed statistics, the claimed luminosity for TLAP is significantly better than the claim for the ILC. Again, I don't think it's quite fair to compare them, right, because, you know, TLAP is much more sort of imaginary numbers than the ILC, but yeah. So let me start the real talk. So this talk is really about potential physics implications of Higgs coupling measurements at these levels of precision. So at SnowMass, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about the numbers, but what do we actually learn, right? Why do we actually care about these numbers too? This or that precision. And I'll talk about two things. One is the connection to naturalness. And I think there is a sort of robust model independent connection to the issue of naturalness. Okay. And the second one is, I think, a similarly robust and model independent connection to the dynamics of the electric phase transition, and in particular, the question of whether the phase transition is first order or second order. Okay. So let's start with naturalness. I think for this audience, I don't really need much introduction, so let me go through it quickly. So I'll take a sort of very minimalist view of naturalness. So I will not, you know, demand that things remain nice up to the gut scale or whatever. So we've probed physics indirectly up to 10 TeV scale. We know there is nothing insanely crazy going on, no strong coupling, maybe some new particles. But we know that there isn't a sort of brute cutoff to our loops until at least 10 TeV. So let me put the brute cutoff at 10 TeV and look at the famous renormalization of the Higgs mass, right? And what I find is that the first loop correction estimated with the cutoff of 10 TeV is about 500 times larger than the value of the Higgs mass parameter that you measure. So this is the fine tuning if we have just the standard model until 10 TeV. Okay, and then you can improve it. Of course, it has some assumptions. The standard model is an effective theory. There are new propagating degrees of freedom. So these are standard assumptions. I don't really want to get into them. Yeah.
If you make a subtraction, mm-hmm. which is just n squared log n over mu, and mu is a renormalization product. So if the n
if there are new particles.
If n is a normalized mass, so if n is a top mass, then the fine tuning is not that serious.
Well, if there are new degrees of freedom at 10 TeV, right, or above, then they would come in, and the mass of those new degrees of freedom would replace this lambda. That's, I mean, lambda is really a stand-in for the mass of new degrees of freedom at a high scale. That's the way to read it. So, so this is really the contribution from heavy degrees of freedom. So if you don't want this fine-tuning, right? And so again, the assumption here is that there are new degrees of freedom at some heavy scale, which I sort of don't. Well, we can talk about this more. But if you want to reduce this fine tuning, you can introduce new particles that come in at the TeV scale, so before 10 TeV. And as most of you know, there are a few mechanisms for doing this. Supersymmetry is the most famous one. And then there's little Higgs, gauge-Higgs unification, and so on. Okay. So in supersymmetry, the most important contribution to M squared is from, loops of tops in the standard model. In SUSY, they would be canceled by superpartners of tops, the stop particles. And so the most important particles for discussing naturalness and supersymmetry at the LHC scales are stops and gluinas. And so motivated by this, people have been focusing a lot on searches for stops and gluinas, okay, at the LHC. As you know, we haven't found anything yet. I think this is certainly not good news for supersymmetry or physics beyond the standard model in general. But I think at this point, it would be premature to conclude that physics necessarily has to be fine-tuned. Okay, and the reason is that the searches, any searches at a hadron collider like the LHC, are sort of sensitive to fairly detailed information about the final states. So just to give you an example, this is one of the famous plots that LHC experiments show us, where they show the bounds on the stop mass, right, from searching for stops, pair production of stops, which then decay to top quarks and neutralinas. Okay. So usually these plots are described as LHC places a lower bound on the stop mass of 700 or 800 GeV. That's the line here, right? However, there is a second direction to this plot, the neutralino mass, right? The particle that the stop decays into. And this 700 or 800 only applies if that particle is light, right? In that case, there is a lot of energy in the decay. There is a lot of missing energy. And so these events are very different from the standard model TT bar. If the neutralino is heavier, for example, this point here, the neutralino is above 250, so here it is, 250, okay? Then the bounds disappear. So there is actually no bound at all for neutralino masses above 250, okay? And the reason is that those decays start looking too much like the standard model TT bar, and since the rate for standard model TT bar is very large, they just cannot separate potential new physics from the standard model background, okay? So this point is at present perfectly allowed. It has a stop mass of about 400, okay? I didn't dwell on this formula, but roughly speaking, the fine tuning goes like the stop mass over 200 GeV squared. That's a sort of rule of thumb. That's right, yeah. So yeah, you need to have.
And that requires other assumptions, that there's no contribution from the running.
Yeah, this is all low cutoff. I'm not talking about high scales. This is, you know, minimalist approach where I don't care about scales above 10 TeV. So that's the context here. So if you want to talk about high scale physics, things are different. I totally agree.
Fixed point. If you ignore the Gluino contribution, there should be an IR fixed point for the ratio between HR, stop right, and stop left. That wants to make one of these MHR negative, stop right, zero, and one heavy.
Yeah.
So that means they are not degenerate, right? Stop right and stop left are not degenerate. An IR fixed point of the RGs. So that has nothing to do with UV assumptions. So explicitly, the statement.
Well, it does have to do with what smarter content you have. Right? You're assuming that.
No, just
you're
assuming just if they may, I'm assuming they're derived, so yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is UV sensitivity to the matter.
Yeah, I mean, there is. I mean, I sympathize with those arguments, but I think the point here, maybe we should discuss this later, but the point I want to make here is not, I don't want to, you know, get into this discussion just because the only point of this slide here is that there are loopholes just as a, if you just think about searches for stops or anything else at the LHC, there are loopholes which allow them to be quite light. Without, you know, without sort of going into small corners of parameter space. Okay, now how it plays out in models, maybe in sort of broad model contexts is a different matter, but my only point here is that you can still have, you know, stop-like particles that are very light and that would not be detected at the LHC, and there are good sort of physics reasons for that. They're just hard to see. So that's the only point I'm trying to make here.
I think the bound vector, Marion, I think, looks much stronger than this.
By the way, there is also a search. Yeah, isn't there a search by Alessandro Strumia and Pierre where they cover, when they do a razor analysis and they actually exclude the M-stop degenerate M-stop?
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's somewhere here, so there is this thing. I mean, yeah, there are parts of you can get into that region with various things, but there are gaps. There are big gaps.
No, that it's a theory analysis, but it does cover that region and stop the general top, right?
Yeah. For very light, yeah, for like 200-250 GeV. Yeah. It's around here. Up here I don't think there's still a ratio here. Mm-hmm. That's right. Anyway, so we should talk about this more later, but my sort of point here is really very simple, right? So this is a talk about Higgs couplings. So my point here is just that, you know, there are scenarios in SUSY or any other model resolving naturalness that are hard to find in direct searches. Okay. So another example is R-parity violation. Which produces just purely hadronic final states that are very difficult to find. I mean, there are efforts, there will be efforts continuing at the LHC to try to cover as much of those scenarios as possible. But I think it's interesting to at least think about an alternative approach, which is indirect search for the stop partners using Higgs coupling. Okay. And I'm going to argue that that actually doesn't have any, it's completely independent of how the top partners decay. So it has a different, conceptually different limitations. Okay. So this argument of connection between Higgs couplings and naturalness has been made in context of various theories. I want to, instead of sort of going through examples, I want to make a sort of general sweeping argument. Even though there are some exceptions to this, so this is not a complete theorem. But the sort of general story, general intuition goes as follows. So the one loop quantum corrections to Higgs potential are given by this famous Coleman-Weinberg potential formula, right? And the only input is the Higgs dependent masses of all particles, right? So you calculate this by doing a background field calculation where you turn on some isotropic Higgs VEF and the masses of all the particles in your theory will depend on that, and those are these functions M, and they go into this calculation, right? And if you start expanding this potential around zero, the second derivative is basically the correction to the mass squared of the Higgs. And if you look at, for example, the top, you see that there's the quadratic divergence that I showed you on the first slide, right? So that's how it comes in this formula. Now, if you want to cut it off, you introduce a top partner, right? The top partner mass, in general, under certain assumptions, but it's quite general, can be expanded like this. There is the bare mass that it has before the electric symmetry breaking. Then it has a term proportional to h squared. There's no term proportional to H because of pH symmetry. And then there are sort of higher order corrections that I'm going to ignore. Okay. So the cancellation of the quadratic divergence basically fixes this coefficient C. It gives you a sum rule that relates C to the top yield value. Right? So that's what I call a top partner. It's the guy that cancels the quadratic divergence in the top loop. And if you look at, you know, models we know, like stops or top partners in little Higgs theories, they all obey the sum rules in their own ways. Okay. Yeah.
There used to be an old petition called development petition for canceling.
Yes.
And so it gives the wrong Higgs mass.
That's correct.
That's still true.
That's correct, yeah. So the Veltman condition assumes no new particles,
right?
And then it's the standard model itself, right? So here I'm saying I'm introducing a new particle and I'm choosing its coupling to satisfy that without changing the Higgs mass. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then the remaining, potential fine-tuning comes from the remaining logarithmic divergence that remains after you choose your Cs. Right, but the point is it's expressed entirely in terms of the C's, which are fixed, and this bare masses, right? And of course, it gets more fine-tuned as you increase the bare masses. Right? That's pretty obvious. So what does it have to do with Higgs couplings? Well, let's think about the Higgs couplings to gauge bosons, such as gluons and photons, right? It's been known for a long time, since the 70s, that there are so-called low-energy theorems which basically express the any particle, but in particular the top partner contribution to these couplings, in terms of the same object, the Higgs-dependent top partner mass. Right. So that's really the only input into these formulas, right? And it's the same function that determines the size of the correction to the Higgs. Okay. So if you plug in the this form for the top partner mass, and again, ignore the dot, dot, dot terms, assume they're small, right? Then you find these formulas for the coefficients of the gamma-gamma, Higgs-gamma-gamma, and Higgs-Ruglu operators, where they're normalized so that they're one in the standard model, okay? The formulas are a little bit hard to read, so let me just point out the sort of important features of them, which is only two. So first of all, they're proportional to Cs, right, which just means that the size of the effect is proportional to the strength of the coupling of the top partner to the Higgs, right? But of course, you cannot make C small because they're fixed by the sum rule. So there has to be at least something there that's a 4 of 1 because top Yukawa is order of 1. Right? Okay, so that fixes the numerator, essentially. And the denominator, you know, has C's and the bare masses. And of course, it gets smaller as you increase the bare masses. Right, as it should, since they should decouple as you make them higher. Right. And so since C's are basically fixed and the scaling is basically inverse with the square of the bare mass, right, you see immediately that there is an inverse correlation between fine-tuning, right, which is proportional to m squared, and the non-standard model contributions to these couplings, which is proportional to 1 over m squared. Right. And the point is, of course, you know, it totally makes sense that if new physics is heavy, then this contribution is small, and then it's fine-tuned. But the point is because all of it has to do with sort of couplings to the Higgs, you really cannot separate these things. So C's here are fixed. So the only way to get rid of this effect without an increase in fine-tuning is to sort of artificially arrange, to throw in a few top partners and artificially arrange cancellations between them, which I think would be a sort of different form of fine-tuning. Okay, so that's the connection. Now, there is one exception to this, which is the possibility that the quadratic divergence in the top mass is canceled by some non-colored and non-electrically charged partners. There are actually models like this at one loop. It doesn't persist to higher loops, but at one loop, there are models like this. So they would not obviously affect glu-glu and gamma-gamma couplings. So for now, we just keep it as an exception, so keep it in mind, and we'll come back to it later in the talk. Yeah.
Just to put it in simple terms, what top partner mass solves the problem?
So the top partner mass that solves the problem completely is 200 GeV.
Is what?
200. 200
it's pretty,
it's pretty low, yeah. After that, I mean, after that, it becomes a matter of how fine-tuned are you willing to the theory to be to not call it a problem.
What
about TEV? Right. So TEV, so it scales like the square. So TEV is about 1 part in 25. So I don't know if that's you would call it fine-tuned or not. That's you know, always the problem with this naturalness arguments. There is no real cutoff where you say beyond that. You don't want to talk about it. Okay. So anyway, so let me try to show you how well this hex coupling measurements that I showed you at the beginning would actually do in this direction. Okay. And to quantify it, let's just take a simplest example. Let's take a single top partner with spin zero, so like stop, with quantum numbers of the standard model stop. So this would be MSSM with two degenerate stops. Okay. With, of course, something else to raise the Higgs mass, like NMSSM or something. So here is the plot. It's basically a one-parameter model, right? So once you know the mass of the top partner, you know the size of the deviation in the gluon coupling. And this is a well-known result in the MSSM, so we're not really, you know, discovering anything new here. But just to, you know, put numbers on what I've been talking about, basically 1% measurement of the Higgs coupling to the gluon would probe the top partner mass up to about 1.2 TeV. So that's roughly the sort of going rate for these things that you should keep in mind when you think about. RG is just fractional deviation of the Higgs boson from the standard model. So if you measure it to 1%, well, of course, you know, the caveat is if you want to discover it at 3 sigma, you need to measure it at 0.3% to see a 1% effect at 3 sigma. But whatever, the prediction for a top partner of 1.2 TeV is 1% deviation.
What is the green and yellow hash region?
Oh, so these are actually the fits to these are the current fits. So this is allowed at 95% confidence level. It's a little bit misleading because right now the central value is below one by about one sigma, so it looks a little bit stronger than it should. But anyway, yeah.
Okay. Next June, they'll
have data, hopefully,
for
13 TeV. Mm-hmm.
So they should be able to see something in 1 TeV.
Well, so again, in terms of direct searches, it depends very strongly on what the decay channels are. So it's not that if there is something at 1 TeV, they're guaranteed to see it. Right? There are things that there are stops with 150 GeV masses that are allowed. If there's R parity violation and they decay to jets, 150 GeV stop is allowed after LHC-8 and will be allowed after LHC-13. So yeah, I mean, the direct searches are great. They're a great way to discover things, but they're not hermetic. They don't cover all the possible scenarios because the backgrounds are huge. And if your events look too much like some standard model events, then there are sort of limitations to what you can do.
You still tell us something.
Well, I hope they discover something. That would be significant. Okay. So anyway, you know, I don't know what the take-home message is, but this is how well Higgs coupling measurements can do in terms of probing top partners. Now, one caveat here that's important to remember is that, you know, of course, this interpreting any deviation in the gluon coupling as the top partner loop assumes that the standard model loop is unchanged, right? That assumes that the TT bar Higgs coupling has its standard model value, right? And that needs to be independently confirmed. And that's actually very difficult to do at the LHC. So as far as I know, the only way to do it at the sort of percent-like levels of precision, I don't know the exact number, but the only way to get down to percent-level measurements is to have a plus and minus collisions at large enough energies to have TTH on shell, which would be about 500 GeV. All right, and okay, so what does it tell us in terms of fine tuning? I think I already said it answering one of your questions. So the fine tuning of, so a bound on 1 TeV implies fine tuning of at least about 1 part in 25. All right, so to sort of emphasize again this point, this is complementary to direct stop searches in the sense that there are no compressed stealthy RPV or other holes that, direct stop searches suffer. It has, of course, its own hole. If there is more than one partner, it's possible that their effects, right, it's an indirect test. So there is always a possibility that the effects of the two top partners cancel for some reason or for no reason at all, actually, that anybody knows about in this particular observable. And this just kind of shows in some slice of parameter space how this can happen. So there's these two lines, basically, or points where you just see accidental cancellations between the two stops contributing to this observable. So that's possible. So in that case, you know, the Higgs coupling deviation, so stops can be light without inducing deviations in Higgs to gamma gamma couplings. But I think this is sort of fine tuned in its own way. Okay, I just said it. So let me move on to the second half of the talk, which is about Higgs and electroweak phase transition. So let me first of all talk a little bit about just electroweak phase transition. So at high temperatures, which pertain in the early universe, electroweak symmetry is restored. So the Snellroth model predicts that, and essentially every extension of the Snellroth model, with maybe some strange exceptions, but all normal theories predict that the symmetry is restored simply because the Higgs gets an effective mass in this high temperature plasma. It interacts with other things. Moving through the plasma, it gets a thermal mass. This thermal mass is always positive, and it's at high temperatures just proportional to T squared. And so at high enough temperature, the effect of Higgs mass is always positive, right? The thermal mass wins over the negative bare mass that it has at zero temperature. Okay. And so in the early universe, the Higgs VF is zero. And then at some point, as temperature decreases, you know, this condition is not satisfied anymore. And there is a phase transition in which the Higgs gets a VF and electroweak symmetry is broken. Okay. So this happened about 10 to minus 10 seconds after the Big Bang, or temperatures of about 100 GeV, just because that's where the weak scale is. And as most of you know, baryon asymmetry may have been produced during this phase transition. There is the scenario of electroweak baryogenesis. This is, of course, not the only scenario for producing baryon asymmetry, but this is the only one at a sort of low energy scale where we can directly probe them, sort of get a lot of information about it from colliders. A successful electroweak baryogenesis requires a strongly first order phase transition. Okay, and that's just because, you know, one of the criteria for successful baryogenesis is deviation from thermal equilibrium. And this scenario relies on a first order transition to produce that.
What's the scenario here if the reheating temperature is below 100 GeV? So if it's not in a thermal plasma, if it's...
Right. So if it's below 100 GeV, then I think it will probably just end up in the... Well, I think it will just end up in the broken phase. It will never be in the restored symmetry phase.
There's no way to do it the way we're doing at that point. You don't have spectral awareness.
Yeah, so I think there is no way to have electroweak baryogenesis for sure, but I think there is also just no phase transition to
well,
speak of.
Well, no, that's not true. Yeah. No, because you have the Hubble temperature.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The phase transition does take place. But.
Yeah, but then you can have, I mean, you may have baryogenesis too, right? Because I don't know how effective it would be, because Hubble would still act like an effective.
You don't excite anything, right?
Is that obvious? Because there's fluctuations of the Higgs field anyway, right? There are no thermal, but there's no thermal buffer particle, but
right.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not there.
Experts, what do you
think? I don't know if I can comment on the Hubble scenario. I mean, I know that there are low reheat temperature scenarios where you can get a for sort of base transition. If say that they're these super cool molecular very dense models where you find yourself in a Hubble's vacuum, and then you tunnel at very low temperatures.
No, but that's human.
Yeah, usually. But I'm just saying that you can have a similar setup where it's stabilized not by the square.
Yeah.
The universe
may
change.
In many ways. More than one. You have to throw people.
Yeah,
that's
a good point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. All right. So, so in the standard model, it's well established that the transition is second order. Okay. Again, this assumes, as you said, reheating temperature above the weak scale, so it cools down, goes through a second order phase transition. Okay. But physics beyond the standard model at the weak scale can modify dynamics, and that can induce a first order phase transition. Okay. So that's kind of the scenarios that that we'll be focusing on here, and just. In cartoons, what's a first order phase transition? Well, it's when you develop a false minimum in the effective potential at some temperature. This false minimum at some point drops below the minimum at zero, where you were at high temperature. And at this point, it becomes energetically favorable for the Higgs field to tunnel from here to here. And this happens through this bubble nucleation mechanism. And then after a while, the bubbles collide and things settle down, and you end up in this minimum at low temperatures, and that's where we are today. Okay. Now, if you want to characterize how strongly first order this transition is, a good way to do it is this dimensionless ratio, right? Called sometimes transition strength, where you take the VEF, the Higgs value, in the false minimum at the critical temperature at the time when these two have the same energy, right? And you divide by the critical temperature, and you can show that you know, for electric baryogenesis to be successful in these scenarios, this ratio needs to be roughly speaking larger than one. Okay, and people have done detailed numerical studies where they claim that this number is 0.9 or something like that, but it's basically basically order one number. Okay, so. So what does it have to do with Higgs couplings? Well, one way to sort of test this, right, would be to just try to run this phase transition in reverse. Would be to sort of try to create plasma in the laboratory with restored electroweak symmetry, right? This would require a sort of Rick-like experiment at the TeV scale. And as far as I know, there's no possibility of ever doing it. So I don't know. However, there is a very tight connection between this finite temperature potential and the zero temperature potential of the Higgs. Okay. So in particular, I'm going to argue in the rest of this talk that it's very hard to induce large modifications of the finite T potential, which are required to turn the order of the transition from second in the standard model to first, without also significantly modifying the zero temperature Higgs potential and also its coupling. Okay, so if this is true, then you can hope that precise measurements of Higgs couplings can probe the nature of electroweak phase transition. Okay, so there are two basic mechanisms for first-order electroweak phase transition. There's three-level mixings or loop-induced corrections, and I'm going to focus on the loop-induced corrections just to kind of turn it into a finite range of things to discuss. Okay, so. They also seem, it seems like if something is loop induced, maybe it's harder to probe. So maybe if we can probe these, the tree level will be easier. I think they're both okay. All right, so so what's the setup? Well, this is sort of, you know, the starting point for this is the scenario for a first order phase transition that has been studied a lot in the minimal supersymmetric standard model. Where it's known that for some conditions, the loops of stops can induce a first order transition. Okay. So basically, we, you know, we don't want to be in the MSSM, we want to be more general. The idea is loops of scalars can induce a cubic term in the effective potential, and that cubic term can lead to a first order phase transition. So let's just introduce some new scalar. I will call it phi. It's coupled to the Higgs through this potential, has a Z2 symmetry, so there is no, well, also in most of our models, it has gauge quantum numbers that would forbid other couplings, like cubic couplings anyway. We just write this quartic coupling, and then it has a self-coupling that will not play much of a role, okay? So once again, so this is the Coleman-Weinberg formula that I already showed you. This is the thermal, the one-loop thermal potential, right? So this is the effective potential at finite temperature that the Higgs field sees. And once again, everything in it is determined by the same object, the field-dependent mass of the of various fields in your theory. So the Higgs background, Higgs is turned on as a background field. You compute the masses of all the particles in your theory, and those determine the thermal potential. Okay. And so again, you know, the same object determines the deviations of the gamma-gamma and glue-glue couplings if this new particle is colored and or electrically charged, which is, again, not the only possibility, and we'll come back to it. Okay, but if it's colored or charged, then you expect direct correlation between the size of the cubic coupling induced at finite temperature, and therefore the strength of the first-order electric phase transition, and the non-standard model contributions to Higgs glue-glue and Higgs gamma-gamma. Okay, so can run through a little analytic example. Let me be very brief. So if you set the bare mass, so M naught was the bare mass of this phi field. If you set that to zero, you can actually do a lot of things analytically, at least at this level. You can expand the thermal potential at high temperature, and then you can just find the location of the broken symmetry minimum at finite T, and you can compute this critical temperature and also the value of the VEF at the critical temperature, and you can figure out for what parameters you get a strongly first-order phase transition. And you end up with this condition. So kappa is the coupling of the scalar to the Higgs here, right? G phi is just the number of degrees of freedom in the field phi. But basically, without getting into details, the condition is kappa has to be a big number, right? So your field should better have a strong coupling to the Higgs, right? And if your field has a strong coupling to the Higgs and it's light, M naught is zero, then it will produce large deviations in the gluon Higgs couplings if it's, for example, colored. So for example, in this case, if you assume it's a triplet, it's fundamental of SU3, you find something like a 12% deviation in the gluon. Okay. Now, of course, this is only for zero bare mass. You can ask, what if I increase the bare mass? Well, of course, you know, that suppresses the deviations of Higgs couplings. But it also decouples from the phase transition exponentially once the mass becomes above the weak scale, right? So basically, if it's too heavy, it doesn't modify the Higgs couplings, but it's useless for getting a first-order phase transition anyway. And so to kind of understand this better, we did some numerical studies, which include a bunch of things which were not included in this analytic example. So it includes, for example, standard model contributions to thermal potential, most obviously, which are important. It includes things like some of the non-perturbative effects that are known to be important in this business and that people know there are sort of standard techniques for dealing with that. It also includes not doing high T expansions. So it turns out that in the interesting range of model parameters, the high temperature expansion is actually not a good expansion. But here we're doing everything numerically anyway, so it's fine. And then we analyze a few toy models that kind of representative of the range of possibilities for quantum numbers of the phi field. Okay, so those don't affect the phase transition very much, but they do affect the collider signals, right? And so we looked at a few things. We looked at something with quantum numbers of right-handed stop, right? So that's what the MSSM has. except in our case, we treat this coupling to the Higgs, coupling of this stop-like particle to the Higgs as a free parameter. We don't fix it to be the top Yukawa. Okay. Then we have some more exotic things. We have, for example, exotic sextet, which is in the 6 of SU3. And it has this funny hypercharge 8/3, which prevents it from coupling to 2 quarks. It can only couple to 4 quarks. So it decays to 4 jets, and therefore it's hard to see. And therefore you can hide it even if it's pretty light from direct searches. Okay. And then we looked at some things that are not colored, including here a complete singlet. And again, as far as electric phase transition is concerned, it doesn't care very much what these quantum numbers are. It cares about this multiplicity a little bit, but that's about it. Okay. So so the results of this analysis are all in the form of these plots. Okay. So let me tell you what the different lines are. So this is an example of the sextet, one of the toy models that we looked at. Okay. So the left plot is Higgs glu-glu deviations. The right plot is Higgs to gamma-gamma. Okay. The axes are the kappa, the strength of the coupling of the scalar to the Higgs, and m phi, which is actually the physical mass of this scalar in the broken phase. So this is what the mass it has today. So the mass that, you know, the LHC would see if they discovered it. Okay, in the purple region, the phase transition happens the system goes into a wrong vacuum, a vacuum without electric symmetry breaking or with color breaking, before the actual electric phase transition happens. And so we kind of exclude these regions from consideration. Some of them may actually eventually end up in the correct vacuum, but it will not actually change our conclusions, as I'll tell you in a minute. Okay. So then there are the black lines. The black lines show this phase transition strength C. Okay. And so 0.9, the number I quoted for getting a first order electric baryogenesis, is this line here, and then we vary it a little bit just to see how sensitive it is, and it's not very sensitive. Okay. And this C increases as you go down and right. Okay, so basically you get strongly a first order phase transition, sufficiently strong for electric baryogenesis below this line in this region. Okay, and the last one, the orange lines, are the deviations of the Higgs glu-glu coupling from the standard model prediction. Okay, and they are labeled by so they're labeled in as a fraction of the standard model. So when it says 1, it means 100% deviation. Okay. If it's 0.7, it's a 70% deviation. So you see that there is an almost perfect correlation. So as you increase C going down, you also increase going along the orange lines, you also increase the Higgs glu-glu deviation from the standard model. Right? They're not exactly parallel, but very, very close. There is a very good degree of correlation between them. And so what you see here is that, smallest value of the deviation of the Higgs glu-glu coupling from the standard model that's consistent with the first order phase transition in this plot is about 70%. Okay. Now, this should be treated a little bit with a grain of salt, because the reason we cut this plot off here is because kappa gets so large that we stop trusting perturbative calculations. So things are probably slightly non-perturbative already around here, so you really need to be more careful to get the precise number. But the logic of the argument, I think, should survive all that.
Do these plots include the direct production exclusion plots?
No, they do not. In fact, for this guy, so this is the sextet with 8/3 hypercharge.
Yeah.
So it goes to 4 jets. And I think the bounds are very weak. I think they're like 200 Jeff or something. So somewhere down here, there is probably a bound.
But the resonance,
no, it doesn't go to 2 Higgses. So there is, it goes to 4 jets. So it's coupling to the Higgs is just by, This is the only coupling it has to the Higgs, right? So it's always squared. There is a Z2.
It doesn't get the verb.
Yeah, it doesn't get the verb itself. So phi to Higgs, Higgs decay is not,
okay.
Is not there in this model. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it just goes to jets. That's right. Okay. Yeah.
Have you tried applying your numerical calculation to the standard model to see how closely it agrees with that? I'm just trying to get a sense of what the error bars that you take on your near over
T. Well, I mean, we know that it doesn't give a first order phase transition. We haven't looked at any, you know, I mean, there are probably some numerical ways to compare it with the lattice results. We haven't really done that.
Okay.
So it's in the same universality class, but. Okay, so right. So at least at face value, right, the numbers that the bounds on RG that the experimentalists give us rule this out at several sigma now. So for example, Atlas claims about 14% measurement of RG, and this would be you know, five sigma away from that. So this looks ruled out. With the usual caveat that this number is actually assumed standard model total widths. And if they don't do that, then this error bar just blows up and this becomes allowed at, I think, 2 sigma. Okay. All right, so what about triplets? Maybe triplets are more interesting. Well, for the triplets, this is essentially the same plot, just the numbers are different. The minimal deviation, again, you know, with the usual caveat that it's really limited by perturbativity on this side. But our best guess is about 17%, okay? And that's actually not ruled out right now. Notice that to get to the 17%, you need to go to large kappa, right? So this is not the MSSM. This is much larger coupling than the MSSM, right? But this would be probed at 3 sigma at LHC 14, so I think we'll basically know what the answer is if particles in the loop are colored. Okay. So the last thing that I want to spend a few minutes on is the possibility that those particles driving the first order phase transition are not colored. Okay. So what if, just to take an extreme case, what if it's a singlet? So so this would obviously not produce any deviation in Higgs group goo and Higgs to gamma gamma. However, there is this interesting possibility pointed out by Nate Craig, Christoph Englert, and Matthew McCullough that it will produce a small deviation in the Higgs-ZZ coupling, basically through the Higgs wave function normalization. So the logic is just, you know, for argument's sake, let's imagine that the mass of this particle is large compared to V, okay? Then you can integrate it out in a sort of unbroken electroweak phase. You get a dimension six operator that looks like this, okay? And after the Higgs gets a VF, this contributes to the wave function normalization, right? But because it's actually a different operator, this is not removed by the usual wave function normalization. Okay, so this is actually a physical effect. And you can shift it around. It's basically equivalent to a shift in HZZ coupling. Okay. And so the point is it's a small effect. It's about 0.5% or so, 0.55 to 1%, depending on the mass of this particle. Because this HZZ coupling can be measured so precisely at E plus minus Higgs factors, there may be hope to probe it even though it's. So that's the idea for singlets. So let me just show you the plot. So this is a similar plot as before. The numbers are very hard to see. But the point is the minimum deviation we find in the HZZ coupling with a pure singlet inducing a first order phase transition is about 0.5%. And so depending on which set of numbers you believe, this may be probed at, you know, anywhere between 2 and 10 sigma. I don't think we know the actual numbers, but it's at least in the ballpark where you can talk about it for a plus or minus case factor. Okay. And this is the singlet, so this is obviously the hardest case to probe in colliders. Okay. Finally, the final Higgs coupling that's affected by this is the Higgs self-coupling. So this actually we worked on a few years ago before the Higgs was discovered. The point is there is basically the same correlation. So models that, the same logic really, the models that produce a large deviation in the finite temperature potential will produce large deviation in the zero temperature potential. The Higgs cubic is just the third derivative of that potential in the minimum. And so that has to deviate from the standard model. Right, and we ran it with a bunch of different models, including both loops and tree level and things like, you know, h to the six induced phase transition. And we found that in all cases, the minimal deviation of about 20% or more in this Higgs self-coupling whenever you have a first order phase transition. Okay, now, of course, the self-coupling is very hard to measure. So measuring it, you know, discovering it at 20% may require measuring it at much less. But you know, for a lot of models, you actually get order one. So these are all the sort of scans of models where you see a lot of them predict order one deviations in the cubic coupling from the standard model. So I think the cubic will be very interesting. And again, it's very directly connected to the finite temperature Higgs potential and so the electric phase transition. Okay, so let me conclude for the second half of the talk. So a strongly first-order electric phase transition, and with it, electric baragenesis remains a viable possibility in a general BSM context. In this work, we focused on the models where first-order electric phase transition is induced by loops of a BSM scalar with a variety of standard model quantum numbers. Okay, and so in the case of colored scalars, we claim that LHC-14 measurements of Higgs-Glew-Glew will probably be able to conclusively probe the full parameter space with first-order electric phase transition. Well, for non-colored scalars, you clearly need E plus or minus Higgs factories. And if you get to the sensitivities that are claimed by the TLAB proposals, then you should be able to conclusively probe the full parameter space, even if you have just a standard model singlet running in the loop and inducing a first-order phase transition. So that's it.
What the results look like if you were to, say, change the criterion of U over TC by a factor of two or so in both directions. Because in this workshop, there's a lot of discussion about the uncertainties that go into these calculations.
Uh-huh.
So, for instance, the U over TC of 1 or 0.9, I think there's an assumption that you allow yourself a certain amount of washout in the scale lines in the
right
phase. And then usually they actually assume a lot of washout, more than you can probably accommodate with actual. So it
right
might be that
mm-hmm
you need a stronger phase transition. But there are
mm-hmm
also, apparently, the cubic term is not the invariant in the finite temperature potential.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there are also uncertainties. People don't quite know how to calculate that. So it'd be interesting to see sort of whether the conclusions hold up under this order.
Right, right. Well, we tried varying it by 20%. So this is 0.7, 0.9, and 1.1
okay
are these three lines. And you can try to extrapolate. So at this level, it's not dramatic, but
yes,
yeah, point taken.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Maximilian.
Thank you.